Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we will explore some of the history of the civil rights movement and concentrate on a period that I'm sure our guest for this hour would argue hasn't gotten the amount of attention that deserved. Probably most people, when you think of the civil rights movement in the United States, you think about the events and the people of, say, the mid-1950s and 1960s. But it is certainly true that the struggle for civil rights in this country did not begin in the mid-1950s. In fact, it began shortly after World War I. It was a part of history in which the radical left was very important, in which people who fought against segregation in the South tried to link their effort to other civil rights battles around the world. And it's also one, particularly when we get into the Cold War period, where people who opposed integration tried to connect, in the minds of Americans, civil rights with communism. And among the things that did was it crippled Southern white liberalism, and it also worked to narrow the civil rights movement's agenda. All of these points you can find in a book that we'll be talking about this morning. The title of the book is Defying Dixie, The Radical Roots of Civil Rights, 1919 to 1950. The book is published by W.W. Norton by our guest, Glenda Elizabeth Gilmore. She's the Peter V. and C. Van Woodward Professor of History at Yale University. I grew up in South Carolina and has written extensively on Southern history. She's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. All you have to do to be a part of the conversation is to call us. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to use, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number. And the call's on us. That's 800-222-9455. And at any point, questions are welcome. We just ask people to try to keep their comments brief so that we can keep moving along, get in as many different people as possible. But certainly, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Gilmore, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm just fine. Do call me Glenda.
All right, well, I'll do that. I appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
And I think here, just again, as I said, a very important idea to get into people's minds at the beginning here is that and as much as we think about the 50s and the 60s as being the key period for civil rights activism in the United States, that, in fact, this movement did not start in the 1950s. It began considerably before that, certainly before World War II.
Yes, David, you gave such a marvelous summary of my book. I don't want to repeat you, but I think there's a quote in the book. Some interviewers who are interviewing elderly African-American Southerners about the civil rights movement come to an old elderly in his 90s black man's home, and they said, "So when did the civil rights movement come to your town?" And he looked at them as if they were crazy and said, "Well, I've been in the civil rights movement all my life." I argue in the book that the struggle to overturn white supremacy in the South, which was a legal system of oppression that involved the suppression of voting rights, the segregation was part of it, a kind of racialized capitalism, the fact that black people couldn't take jobs above a certain level and certain jobs with low pay were reserved for black people. I argue that all of that was well established by World War I, but that as soon as it was established, African Americans began to fight it, and they fought it with everything they had. Sometimes they had to leave the South and cross the Mason-Dixon line and fire shots back across those borders. I also argue that it was a much broader kind of attack on segregation and white supremacy, what they called Jim Crow, than the more concentrated Civil Rights Act that we tend to know about in the 1950s. That movement that is in everyone's history book is actually sort of a vestige of the larger movement that came before.
Mm-hmm. And just to, again, make sure that people know when one uses the phrase Jim Crow,
What
is it you're talking about? And what you're talking about is an institutionalized system of segregation that existed in law in the South for quite a long time.
Yes. In fact, African Americans and whites both referred to that system, which had many tentacles and many requirements, as Jim Crow, and they referred to the South as Dixie. That didn't mean that there wasn't discrimination in the North, that there wouldn't be restaurants that wouldn't serve black people or hotels, et cetera, or that there weren't really neighborhoods. There were neighborhoods in the North that black people couldn't move into, or if they tried, they would have trouble. But in the South, it's very difficult to explain how all-encompassing this system was. It was everything from a legal system to a kind of choreography of daily life. It dictated where you walked, where you went, what you said, if you were black, and even if you were white. It sort of put white people in a certain place that they had to behave in a certain way. And it was pervasive until the 1950s.
And I think here, you make an important point that people, not just in the South, looked at this system as something that could be exported to deal with what they considered to be the, quote, problem of race. And sometimes I think what they meant by the problem of race was simply the existence of black people. People elsewhere in the North and maybe even people elsewhere in the world looked at this and thought, what a wonderful system this would be to regulate society and make sure that the worlds of people of color and everybody else don't they exist side by side, but in a sense they don't mix.
That's absolutely true. One of the most surprising things to me about writing this book was how international white Southerners saw this system. They saw a lot of potential. They felt like they had been the first to solve the problem of a racially divided society. Most people think that these things went back to slavery and emancipation, but in fact, white Southerners saw Jim Crow and white supremacy as modern. They took their cue from eugenics, which came from evolution, and they wanted to export the system in its entirety around the world. They felt like they had a lot to offer, for example, the British, who had colonized people of color, or the Australians, who were faced with immigration from Asia. One of the leading Australian politicians said when a black jazz musician dated a white Australian woman, said, well, if we were really men, like men in the white South, we would lynch this guy. We wouldn't put up with this. They know how to handle this kind of thing in the South. Indeed, we ran, white Southerners ran schools for white South Africans on how to promote sort of peaceful yet incredibly unequal race relations among Native peoples and the colonizers.
The first section of the book, and actually this is something that really runs all through it, but it particularly looks at how it is that communists in both in the United States and in the Soviet Union apparently saw a great opportunity to organize African Americans and to enlist them in the revolution in an international sort of sense. Talk about that.
Yes. Actually, the book conveniently divides itself into the decades of the 20s, then the 30s, and the 40s. In the first decade, the 1920s, most of the resistance to white supremacy came from people outside of the South. I call that section of the book incursions. And indeed, communists, both in the United States and in Moscow, felt that the key to organizing in the United States would be to awaken African Americans. They felt that as long as there was a large black labor force in the United States, they would have difficulty organizing a working class. And so racism must be overcome. White and black working class people must learn that their interests are the same And in the Soviet Union, actually, racism was illegal. They had their own problems with integrating a very large Asian and European population. And so they just outlawed racism. They called it social poison. So the Comintern decided that they would enter the South and Dixie in 1928. They would go right to the source and try to organize white cotton mill workers along with black people who worked outside the mill. And they sent black and white organizers to North Carolina to do just that.
One of the things that I think is really noteworthy about the book is that it introduces one to characters who were involved in the struggle that you probably hadn't heard of before. And here in this section, you talk about a man named Lovett Fort Whiteman. He was the first African-American to join the Communist Party. And he was certainly a remarkable character. Talk about him.
Lovett Fort Whiteman is an amazing person. He was born in 1889 in Dallas, and his dad had been a slave, had gone from, after emancipation, from Alabama to Texas. And Lovett went to Tuskegee, which was, of course, the very conservative African-American college. And then sometime after World War I, he joined the Communist Party. I'm unclear on when, because J. Edgar Hoover locked him up for several months, and the record, he sort of vanishes from the record in 1919 for about 2 years. By 1924, Lovett Fort Whiteman is in the Soviet Union. Later in the decade, he attends a university there called the University of Toilers of the East, which is the school to which they send colonized people. Ho Chi Minh from Vietnam was there. And so it's a school where they teach people who are within a nation or who are colonized how to rise up against their oppressors. Lovett is a larger-than-life figure. He comes back to the United States with his head shaved, wearing a long shirt, a rabotchka with a sash and knee-high boots. And in 1928, he goes to live in the Soviet Union permanently. He calls it going home to Moscow. Lovett Fort Whiteman is an old Bolshevik. He believes that he is building a revolution around the world. And in that revolution, he's absolutely convinced that he's as good as Stalin or anyone else. And he represents American black people. So when Stalin begins to consolidate power, Lovett Fort Whiteman does not shut up. And all through the early 30s, he's outspoken, often against Stalin, often saying that the Soviet Union is abandoning the kind of early zeal that they had in the United States, in the South, trying to overturn racism. And so Stalin exiles Whiteman. He ultimately is sent to the Gulag, where he dies in 1939 of starvation. His teeth are knocked out, and he dies a broken man.
I'd like to introduce again our guest for this hour, for anyone who might have just tuned in, Glenda Elizabeth Gilmore. She's professor of history at Yale University. She writes extensively on Southern history, Southern American history, and is the author of a recently published book that looks at the radical roots of civil rights in the period between 1919 and 1950. The book is Defying Dixie, and it's published by W.W. Norton. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. How successful was the Communist Party in attracting African Americans?
In the beginning, the Communist Party tried to organize people at their workplaces, and since in the South, work was so racially divided, it wasn't extremely successful. There were probably 50 black members of the Communist Party, many of these people in Atlanta and Alabama, before about 1931-32. But what began to happen with the Great Depression was that starvation broke down a lot of racial barriers, and the Communist Party in the South started something called the Unemployed Councils, and 2,000 people would march to the mayor's office in a particular town and demand what today I think we would call welfare, some kind of relief. And so the Communist Party became pretty successful in the early 30s. The other reason that they became successful was that they supported 9 African-American men who were arrested for raping two white women near Scottsboro, Alabama. And the two white women had been hoboing on railroad cars, and when they found themselves sort of in a pinch because they weren't supposed to have been doing that and they were drunk, they accused these black men who had been on the train of rape. And it was clearly a put-up job, and one of the women recanted, but the communists defended them. And this became a worldwide cause. And in the United States, particularly in the American South, it drew a lot of members. For example, I did get the records. There's only one set of membership records applications that are available, but in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Danville, Virginia, and Spartanburg, South Carolina, there were 90 members of the Communist Party. More than half of them were black in 1931, and they had joined the Communist Party because they felt like it was the only institution in the South that would stand up for people who were both poor and black. Mm.
Did that make it difficult for the communist organizers, who were also trying to organize, obviously, trying to attract white workers, the fact that they had this broad kind of agenda and that they believed in equal rights for African Americans, was that difficult for them in their working to organize white people?
Well, I think it was difficult. It also had a kind of secret payoff. One thing that a lot of white people clearly would not be in any kind of organization with black people. And after 1928, the Communist Party would kick anyone out of the party who tried to discriminate. For example, if they had separate meetings of white and black workers, and the white workers objected, it would be the white workers they kicked out of the party. No doubt, this confused poor white people in the South. It angered them, and it drove many of them away from the Communist Party. But the silver lining was that the white people it didn't drive away from the Communist Party were fearless. They understood that class trumped race, and that the white elite had been holding down everyone's wages by keeping black people at the bottom of the totem pole, and they had more in common with poor black people than they did with elite white people. So ultimately, the policy of total racial equality, and that included explicitly social equality, the right to marry someone who was of a different race, that policy produced fearless white Southerners who were willing to take on the Klan or anyone in order to organize workers.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, so let us do that. And here in Champaign County, where we are, this is line number one. Hello.
Hi. How does the fact that the NAACP was founded after the so-called 1908 race riot in Springfield, Illinois, which was not really a race riot, it was an attack on a rather black bourgeois neighborhood by angry whites, resentment of maybe some class dimension, was on the pretext, as usual, of some crime against a white woman. But, you know, that's 1908. It influenced the ANC formation in South Africa before the Russian Revolution. There was clearly anarcho-syndicalists and all sorts of ferment at that time that we don't record anymore that weren't in any reductionist sense communist.
That's absolutely right. In fact, Lovett Fort Whiteman came to communism because he was an anarcho-syndicalist and had actually been in Mexico during the Mexican Revolution and joined a group of anarchists. The NAACP has an interesting relationship to the Communist Party and to white Southern racism. When the Communist Party is part of the equation. In the beginning, in 1919, the white Southerners turn against the NAACP. They don't really want any kind of organization for African Americans. They equate the NAACP and the Socialist Party and the Communist Party. During the 1920s, many members of the NAACP are interested in the experiment in the Soviet Union. Du Bois goes to Moscow. Lots of other people do as well. But by the time that Stalin begins to consolidate power and people actually understand what is happening on a world stage with communism in the early 1930s, the NAACP is very careful to position itself in the South as a reasonable alternative to communism, a reasonable alternative in the throes of the Great Depression, when everybody, in fact, is worried about some kind of revolution, not just about a revolution of African Americans, but about a revolution of poor people. The NAACP is able to position itself as an anti-communist organization that will improve the lives of everyone, particularly black people in the South. That doesn't mean that white Southerners always realize the difference. You know, I grew up hearing in the 1950s that the NAACP was a communist organization. Well, of course, no single organization has been as anti-communist for as long and as stalwartly as the NAACP was. So it played a large role, and the role in the book that it plays really increases in the 1930s when the NAACP in 1933 begins to mount litigation against segregated law schools and graduate schools in the South, arguing that black people can't get education beyond college. And they adopt a legal campaign to really attack Jim Crow on that educational segregation issue, saying that that kind of separation in graduate school, law school, can never be equal.
I think that, as you admitted, that there were a lot of other strains. I'm a little frustrated in how this narrative will be reduced.
Exactly. That's a very good. I do not argue in the book that the communists are responsible for civil rights. I argue that, and this, of course, is a, you know, it's a huge sort of issue, because we are talking about three decades. We're talking about lots of different people, and so I do hope you read it. But after the beginning, when the communists are there to offer a radical alternative, I argue that it took a kind of radical left, not just communists, but socialists, and then some people in a Southern Popular Front, to push the middle of white liberals and white and black liberals who are in the NAACP and also in something called commissions on interracial cooperation, that they began in the 1930s in the face of international fascism and in the face of fear of communism, to foresee the end of segregation, which is something they did not foresee in the 1920s. So the book's divided equally into three parts, and by the second part, this radical left has already moved a group of people who really thought that segregation would last 1,000 years. It's already moved them to talking about, well, how can we have some kind of integration in the United States? The NAACP is a major factor, as is the unaffiliated black press, in holding up the mirror of fascism in Germany to the American South. And so I moved to that theme in the 1930s, because as early as 1933, the Nazi oppression of the Jews is front page news in every black newspaper in the country. And from 1933 to 1941, when we entered the war, African Americans and their liberal, even Southern liberal white allies, began to craft a kind of language of tolerance that's based on the fact that we are facing a world that's being subsumed into a fascist war, and that we can't go and fight against the intolerance of fascism if we have anything resembling the same intolerance at home. So there's And the communists are the beginning of the story, but they're certainly not even the middle or the end. There's a wide array of forces who come in. And then the decade of the 40s, it's a different group of people who are pushing things further.
I think this is really an important point. I'm glad here we're getting to this, that that people who were involved in the struggle for civil rights here in the United States did very clearly draw parallels between the Nazis and anti-Semitism and racism that existed in the United States, particularly in the South, but not just in the South, and that they perhaps earlier than a lot of other people were sounding the alarm about Hitler and the Nazi regime in Germany, and this is a global picture here that we have to consider, and that it's all connected.
I think it's really important, as it is to sort of chronologize, to sort of put dates on what happened with the communists and trying to organize black people in the South and push that into the 20s and 30s before Stalin. It's also important to think about how African Americans really played the Southern white supremacy against German fascism in the beginning from, I guess, 1933 and 1934, they argued that it was worse in the American South than it was in Nazi Germany. And indeed, the Nazis argued the same thing. Mm-hmm. Julius Streicher said, well, we haven't lynched any Jews as they do in the southern United States. Perhaps the Jews would like for us to, which was a horrible, chilling sort of expression, but we don't lynch them and torture them the way Southerners do. But after the 1936 Olympics, it became much clearer, and Hitler became much more resolved that he was going to eliminate the Jews. And so by 1937, 1938, black newspapers are saying things like, at least in the United States, we have the right to protest. The Jews do not. For them, there is going to be no hope. And Du Bois said that he had never seen anything worse than the persecution of the Jews. And he added, and I have seen much. So by the end of the 1930s, African Americans are trying to rally black people in the United States in a coalition with American Jews. And particularly because people were actually worried about domestic fascism. There was a novel called It Can't Happen Here, but everyone was quite worried that it was going to happen here. Ultimately, the last couple of years before World War II, it's pretty clear that what is happening. And white Americans begin to realize this, and African Americans have succeeded in calling discrimination a cancer on democracy. Even the Atlanta Journal in 1939 writes, well, if we're going to go fight a fascist war abroad, we have to eliminate the cancer of racial intolerance at home, which is an amazing thing for a white-owned newspaper to say, particularly a newspaper that had been, you know, using the word darkies not 4 years before.
How did African-American activists think about the direct involvement of the United States, I mean, militarily, in the war against Germany? How did they think about that in this period before the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Well, that's a great question, because it, again, it's very contextually linked to the chronology. And one thing that happens from about 1935 until the Nazi-Soviet non-aggression pact in the South, there is a really robust anti-fascist movement that is drawing analogies to white supremacy. And at a meeting, you might have two or three communists. You might have the president of the University of North Carolina, who would be, of course, a white man. You might have some socialists. And you might have people from the Commissions on Interracial Cooperation, which are as middle-of-the-road liberal as you could get. But they're all anti-fascist, but as soon as Stalin and Hitler sign the Non-Aggression Pact, that leaves these white liberals and African Americans, such as the NAACP, out on a limb their anti-fascism was inclusive before that. It included communists because the communists were willing to condemn fascism. But after that, they really have to distance themselves from the communist. The Communist Party is craven because it immediately switches from anti-fascism to anti-imperialism, calling Britain and France imperialist nations and asking the United States not to enter World War II. So African Americans who are in the Communist Party have to make that leap, and they are opposed during the pact to the United States entering World War II. But most African Americans, when you sort out people who aren't in the Communist Party, realize that this is going to happen. They also realized that in World War I, they thought they would fight first and get their reward later. But this time, they're actually fighting this evil of fascism that could affect them. And they're going to fight on two fronts. They're going to fight fascism abroad, and they're going to fight Jim Crow at home. So there's a great resolve to fight. It's simply that they're going to fight on two fronts. And they are going to make some demands up front about desegregating war industries and desegregating the armed forces before they all readily enlist. It's so interesting because you never heard the phrase Negro morale in World War I. It was simply expected that black people would go and fight and stay in menial jobs. But in World War II, right at the beginning of the war and throughout the war, American officials are very worried about Negro morale. And so there's a really interesting and complex discussion about how African Americans are going to fight World War II and what they're going to ask of their country when they return.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Glenda Elizabeth Gilmore. She's the Peter V. and C. Van Woodward Professor of History at Yale University. She writes extensively on Southern history. She's the author of the recently published book, Defying Dixie, The Radical Roots of Civil Rights, that looks at the foundations of the civil rights movement in the period before and during World War II, really getting at the idea that in as much as some people might think of the civil rights movement as being something that began in the 1950s, she would say, no, it certainly didn't begin in the 1950s. It really began in the period right after World War I. Questions are welcome. The book, by the way, is published by W.W. Norton, if you'd like to look at it. Questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Urbana to talk with on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to continue the line of the last caller about the formation of the NAACP. And I've always wondered why Booker T. Washington was so opposed to the formation of the NAACP. I know that W.B. Du Bois is there and Ida B. Wells was there and lots of prominent liberal white people at the time, but it's my understanding that Booker T. Washington even sent, you know, sort of one of his representatives of the machine to the Niagara meeting to try and disrupt it and discourage the formation of the NAACP. Do you have any thoughts or information on that?
You know, my first book goes back into that period.
Oh, okay.
I think that it's called Gender and Jim Crow. And Booker T. Washington could be the most complicated man on the planet. Ida B. Wells Barnett is probably the most complicated woman. But I believe that Washington felt that unleashing a kind of formal organization that included white people and that was public and that was based in the North was going to undercut the behind-the-scenes work that he was doing in the South. For years, we sort of taught Booker T. Washington as a kind of accommodationist, someone who said, okay, we're going to put down our bucket where we are and we're going to start farming and we really don't want to vote. He never said we really don't want to vote, and in fact, he was quite the political wizard, his biographer has called him. He was constantly organizing African-American people and trying to keep them voting. He even protested segregation, funded a couple of lawsuits behind the scenes, And he and Du Bois had a really good relationship until about 1902, 1904, when Du Bois began to break with, sort of decided that he was going to put Booker T. Washington's position and his position into high relief, and he was going to say that Booker T. Washington didn't want to vote and didn't really want to challenge segregation. And, of course, he did, and he went on to be one of the founders of the NAACP. I think that Washington thought that segregation was not here to stay, but was only going to be undermined from within, not directly challenged from without. He's also in a different generation.
Mm-hmm.
He had been a slave, and he had a lot at stake in being the representative of what an ex-slave could do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you grew up in slavery, you know the absolute power of the white South. And Du Bois grew up in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and it wasn't as inscribed on his soul as it was on Washington's soul.
Mm-hmm.
They're different. Also, Booker T. Washington, by the time that the NAACP is founded, has his own organization.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to build up African Americans economically. Years of worrying about Booker T. Washington have brought me to believe that he believed what he was doing would work.
Yeah, I agree with that. I was always a little worried because he had such a presence, and he was seen by so many very wealthy, influential white people as, you know, the most important black person in the United States, and a word from him could dismantle lots of things, and that's why I think Ida B. Wells was so put out with him for, you know, not being more public about anti-lynching, you know, in her work. So
that's right. Yeah. One thing that you've really hit on something that's kind of a problem in the way that we teach history, or at least the way that we used to teach history. Booker T. Washington would be in the textbooks, but dissenting voices would not be in the textbooks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So part of what we know is a kind of simplified account where the white people who wrote the textbooks made Booker T. Washington speak for so many people,
mm-hmm,
and didn't put Ida B. Wells in.
Mm-hmm.
Although she got mad at the NAACP as well because they thought that her temper was,
yeah,
too strong to be sort of an organizational woman. And they didn't really want a strong black woman in the group either. But I think, you know, there's nothing unusual about the fact that African-American people had a lot of different opinions about what they should do.
Yeah, that's what I find so intriguing about all that you've been saying so far. It just shows that, you know, it's not monolithic. You know?
Right, and everybody, in their own way, each person is throwing what they've got, what they believe, against this wall of white supremacy.
Right. Well, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Thank you. Other questions are welcome. Again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I mentioned a little earlier that I think one of the things about the book that's really interesting are the characters in it. And you talked a little bit about Lovett Fort Whiteman. There's somebody else here who is an important character who runs through a lot of this book that I'd like you to talk about, and that is Pauli Murray.
Pauli Murray is a one-woman civil rights movement. She was born in Baltimore in 1910 and grows up in Durham, North Carolina during segregation in the 1920s. She ends up in New York, goes to college there, and is involved in this sort of vibrant working-class culture in Harlem. She's in the WPA. She teaches adult education classes. And about 1938, she decides that she's going to do everything she can for the rest of her life to end segregation. One of the first things that she does, and this is one of the biggest problems in her life, she joins an organization called the Communist Party Opposition, which is communist, but it's not the Communist Party. It's a kind of splinter group led by Jay Lovestone. And she decides after several months that this isn't the kind of organization she wants to be involved with. She's really religious all of her life. She's an Episcopalian. But that months-long membership comes back to haunt her all her life and sort of keeps her out of the mainstream. She tries to sue the University of North Carolina in 1939 because she applies to study social work and sociology at the graduate school at the University of North Carolina. It is the premier place in the South to study what the white Southerners called the Negro problem, and Pauline Murray says she thinks that maybe she has something to contribute on that since she is a, quote, Negro, unquote, yet she is turned down, even though turning her down at that point was unconstitutional because the United States Supreme Court had already ruled that if you don't have a graduate school for black people in sociology, you must admit a black applicant to the white school in sociology. The NAACP ultimately refuses to take her case. At first, I thought that was because she was a woman, but they took other women's cases. They were involved in a campaign in border states to desegregate graduate schools. Then I thought that it was because she was in the Communist Party opposition, and that could have been it. I think they felt that, you know, I think they may have found that out. She was also extremely outspoken. She would send out press releases, but ultimately I think they didn't take her case because she was a gay woman. And people in New York and Harlem knew this. She fought against this because she was a very religious person. So she's a gay civil rights activist in the late 1930s. She goes on to fight against the poll tax, to fight against all-white juries, and then she joins A. Philip Randolph, the leader of the March on Washington movement. She becomes the head of his Committee on Nonviolent Methods and begins to study Gandhi. She's arrested for not moving to the back of the bus in the early 1940s before the war starts, and then she leads the first sit-ins in Washington, D.C. during World War II. I could go on. She is a founder of the National Organization for Women and ultimately was about to be appointed general counsel of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission when sources at the White House said that she had been in this Communist splinter group for a few months in the 1930s, 30 years before, and that cost her that dream. She never stops, however, fighting and becomes the first black woman to be an Episcopal priest, and she is ordained with the first group of women in the Episcopal Church. So she is, in fact, a black gay female Episcopal priest in 1977.
It's a remarkable life. I like your phrase, your description of her as a one-woman civil rights movement. I'd say that's pretty apt, and I would wonder how many people, other than people who did a lot of study of this history, would recognize her name or would really know her, or perhaps would know her for the fullness of her life and all of the things that she did.
I don't think there hasn't been a biography of Pauline Murray, and I don't think that she's very well known. I think there are some reasons for that. One of the reasons is that by the 1950s, she was already an attorney. She had done a great deal of work in the late 1940s fighting against state laws on discrimination. But she was also of the generation before the young civil rights movement. She also had these ties in this membership in the 30s to something that was a communist organization. And in the 1950s, the people who led the civil rights movement knew that they were operating in a Cold War society. They knew that they were operating in a pretty patriarchal society, probably the most male-centered decade, I think. The veterans of World War II had come back. You know, it's the time of Father Knows Best. And so, rightly or wrongly, the people they pushed to the front of the movement were black men, often ministers, who, of course, couldn't be accused of being communist. and who were quite middle class. So there's a sort of theater about the black civil rights movement of the 1950s, which is really the first time that white people knew that any of this was going on because of television. It came into their living rooms. When Pauli Murray twice led sit-ins in Washington, 1943 and 1944, no white newspapers reported it. Only one magazine that was owned by a white person reported it, and that was a far-left magazine. So sit-ins happened earlier, but we white people didn't get to see them. And so when we look around for the roots of the civil rights movement, conveniently, we find it in religious fervor among middle-class black men in the 1950s. When I first got to Yale, Southern newspapers would call and say, some reporter would say, I found a black woman who refused to move to the back of the bus in 1932 or 1940 or something. And they would think that they had discovered what they called the first Rosa Parks. But Rosa Parks was not even the first Rosa Parks. She was the first person who broke through this wall of white obliviousness to what black people had been fighting for decades by that time.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and just as a way of finishing up, I'm interested in having you talk a little bit more about what it meant for the civil rights movement that, and I'm talking about now in the last period here, say in the late 40s and up to 1950s, the fact that we were into the Cold War, there were fears of communism were very, very strong. What that meant for the movement, the fact that in this period up until that point, a lot of the people who were important movers in the movement were, in fact, from the radical left.
That's right. And it certainly took communists, people who were still communists, and there were fewer and fewer because of what they were finding out about Stalin's crimes. It took them out of the civil rights movement. The more problematic thing, I think, though, for implementation of any kind of civil rights victories in the courts is that it also took out white liberals from one of the characters in my book, the president of the University of North Carolina, Frank Porter Graham, had joined organizations, anti-fascist, anti-racist organizations that had included some communists in the 30s and 40s. But he then was forced off the public stage as being, they called him Frank the Front. They said he had been, quote, duped by communism. Pauli Murray was another person like that. So it takes away leaders in the South who could have made a difference in the actual implementation of desegregation. It also makes one of the things that the 50s civil rights movement did was it downplayed any international connections because it's the Cold War and they don't want to look as if they're connected to, in any way, to communism or even to decolonization movements. So what had always been a kind of global protest against racial discrimination became a kind of domestic, insulated process. It also took, it really took a lot of things off the agenda of the civil rights movement. Anything that was an economic goal, equal opportunity in the workplace, residential housing, integrated residential housing, those kinds of things became pinko if you talked about those, because in America, we don't talk about changing either our economic system and we don't touch private property. It also increased, I think, some Southern white resistance to change because Southerners said, well, we fought a war against fascists and now we're fighting a Cold War against totalitarians and you can't tell us what to think. If you do, you are a totalitarian. In other words, we have the freedom to associate or not with African-American people. So there's a whole strain of the 1950s Cold War tactics to really goals that are shaped by the Cold War, as we're always shaped by the history around us. Mm-hmm. One of the things that it does, though, in 1968, when Martin Luther King starts talking about economic goals and poverty, And when black people start talking about black power, many historians have seen this as a departure from the civil rights movement, but it was actually a return to a civil rights movement that was not even 15 years abandoned before that. It was a return to goals that had always been there.
I think that's a really interesting point and something that we actually talked about before on this program, that is there and that, for example, just talking about Dr. King, it's no doubt something that he would have been, if he had had the opportunity to continue, would have been talking more and more about.
That's right. And it's some, you know, he knew about all of this. He's not oblivious. One of his mentors was a guy named Howard Thurman, who was the chaplain at Howard University, who had counseled Pauline Murray when she was studying Gandhi in World War II about sit-ins. They had talked about, well, how could we use this nonviolent stuff here in the nation's capital? And so Howard Thurman then becomes a mentor of Martin Luther King much later. King was aware of this much larger civil rights movement, but he was also a master of political theater, and he knew what it took to succeed. I want to be sure, though, that this is not to diminish his contribution, nor is it to diminish Brown. Brown was the single most important civil rights piece of judicial decision in the 20th century, and it totally changed the South. It totally changed most people's lives. But it's not all that we could have had. Yeah. It's not all that we wanted.
We're going to have to stop, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to stop because we've reached the end of the time. If you would like to read more on this subject, you should look for the book, and I mentioned a couple of times. The title is Defying Dixie, The Radical Roots of Civil Rights, 1919 to 1950. It's published by W.W. Norton's by our guest, Glenda Elizabeth Gilmore. She is an award-winning historian of the American South. She teaches at Yale. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.